Tehran says French President Macron's remarks following his meeting with a U.S.-based anti-Iran activist are regrettable and shameful. The Russian foreign ministry says the U.S. and NATO are militarizing Southeast Asia as part of their efforts to contain Moscow and Beijing. The head of the International Monetary Fund raises the possibility of a second Cold War as a result of rivalry between China and the U.S. Welcome. A top story this hour, French President Emmanuel Macron's recent meeting with anti-Iran activists is drawing a strong reaction from Tehran. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani says the meeting was a flagrant violation of France's international responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and violence. He dismissed Macron's praise for an anti-Iran activist as regrettable and shameful. Kanani says it's surprising that a president of a country that advocates freedom would degrade himself by meeting a dissident who has tried to spread hatred and carry out violent and terrorist acts both inside Iran and against Iran's diplomatic missions abroad. On Friday, Macron met with four notorious anti-Iran women activists, among them Asiya Alinejad, who has for years led an anti-Iran campaign from the U.S. From the Iran Institute of Qom, I'm now joined by Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi. He's an activist and political analyst. Good to have you with us, Sarbaz. So let's have your comment on this meeting between President Macron and anti-Iran women activists.
This is not the first time France is taking hostile stance against the Iranian people, Iranian nation. Unfortunately, we have the history of France in front of us. France was the headquarter, like home for the MEK cult, terrorist cult, that was fighting against the Iranian nation since the very beginning of the Iranian Revolution. MEK terrorists were shuttling between Albania and France easily in all these years, during all those years that MEK was known and announced as a terrorist organization by the European Union and United States of America. Even at that time, MEK had headquarters inside France. And the recent stand in meeting with Masih Alinejad, the notorious, as it was mentioned, activist against the Iranian nation, is not something strange and new. We should not forget that Masih Alinejad's campaign during all years was to bring violence in the Iranian streets. And she followed that campaign even during last couple of months in a very intense way to encourage more people for violence in the streets. She was the one who encouraged by his social media platforms. He brought those who were openly calling for violence, openly calling for attacking the Iranian security forces. As you know, it resulted in tens of, Iranian security forces being killed during the riots that took place. Of course, some civilians also lost their lives, but the number of the, security forces that were, killed during the recent unrest and riots inside Iran was something really shocking if you compare it to any other part of the world. So also you have to know what was her background. She sitting in her million-dollar villa and house in United States of America, she was inviting people to what is so-called social disobedience. And also we do not forget that she was recently nominated by OHI Courage Award, and where she was invited and she was given that Courage Award with Zelensky together, where she talked and she said openly that I'm here to say that the Western countries should not recognize Iran. So her stance against Iran, against Iranian people, against Iranian nation is really clear. And of course, the stand of the French president inviting her, hosting her, and meeting her is not strange, because if we look back to the hostile policies of, unfortunately, France against the Iranian people, we find completely understandable what they are doing. They are trying to make use of their maximum pressure campaign on Iran in all fields and all platforms to push Iran, of course, back from its policies, of course, its regional policies as well.
Thanks for that, Sabah Zuhal Rizvi, activist and political analyst. An Iranian lawmaker has criticized Azerbaijan's president for his recent comments about Turkish-speaking Iranians, calling them unrealistic and untrue. Representative of Zanjan province, Alborz Hosseini, said that Ilham Aliyev's claims about Iranian Turks being parted from their historical land is beneath his dignity. He said that the Azeri president should read the Golestan Treaty to get his facts right. According to Hosseini, had it not been for that treaty, Azerbaijan would still be part of Iran. On Friday, Aliyev said that the government of Azerbaijan pays special attention to protecting the rights of Azerbaijanis living abroad. He claimed that Baku will continue its efforts so that his compatriots, who've been separated from their ancestral land, would preserve their language and tradition. Under the Treaty of Golestan, Iran ceded what is now Dagestan, Eastern Georgia, Republic of Azerbaijan, and parts of Armenia to the Russian Empire in 1813. Now to Syria, where U.S. troops have illegally transferred nearly 100 truckloads of oil and wheat out of the country and into neighboring Iraq. According to Syrian media, more than 70 tanker trucks carrying stolen crude crossed two illegal border crossings into northern Iraq. American forces also smuggled 20 truckloads of Syrian wheat into Iraq. U.S. forces have been involved in the illegal trade of oil from occupied territories in northeastern Syria for several years. Former U.S. President Donald Trump openly acknowledged on more than one occasion that American troops were in that country for its oil. According to the Syrian Oil Ministry, the U.S. and its proxies stole more than 80% of the nation's daily crude output in the first half of this year. Yemen is facing an acute shortage of medical supplies as the Saudi-led coalition is impeding all sorts of imports but continuing the blockade of the country. Abdul Latif al-Washali reports from the capital, Sana'a.
The Yemeni Ministry of Health and Population held a press conference in Sana'a to highlight the impact of the continued Saudi siege on the national drug supply program. The event took place amid a severe shortage of necessary medication in the war-torn country.
The Saudi blockade imposed on the national drug supply program has caused one of the world's worst crises in the health sector. Medicines do not arrive on time at all due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport, which has also led to a high rate of death among people with chronic diseases. Patients can't receive basic drugs such as insulin for diabetics, and this is a tragedy no one talks about.
The ministry says almost 169,000 patients cannot receive life-saving medicine and they are in real danger unless the siege is lifted.
The pharmaceutical system in Yemen has been gripped by the Saudi blockade. International companies have partially or completely left the Yemeni market as they face extra costs as well as seizure of vessels for weeks and months. Moreover, medicines should be delivered in special conditions to maintain their quality and effectiveness. The fuel crisis has also negatively affected the shipment of medication.
Earlier, the member of the National Negotiating Delegation, Abdul Malik Al-Ajri, accused Western powers of preventing the entry of medical supplies into Yemen, saying this precedent has never been witnessed throughout history. Officials believe that Saudi Arabia is deliberately preventing medical supplies from entering Yemen to pressure Sana'a to accept the UN agreement as it is. They say the siege has failed throughout 7 years of the war, and the kingdom's measures will push the Yemeni army to carry out new air strikes. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Indonesia intensifying security measures in Bali, and that's in preparation for an annual summit of the world's 20 largest economies. This year's meeting has been overshadowed by the ongoing war in Ukraine. The G20 leaders and directors of several international bodies will be meeting in the resort island on the 15th and 16th of November. A notable absence from the event will be the Russian president. First arrivals are expected later today, and the heads of state will move between the summit venue and their hotels inside a security ring that's protected by 18,000 military and police officers. Warships, helicopters, and fighter jets have also been deployed as part of the security operation. Bali has seen no major security incidents in 20 years, but the area has witnessed deadly natural disasters, including 2004 tsunami that killed some 170,000 people in Indonesia alone. The Russian foreign ministry says that the U.S. and NATO are militarizing Southeast Asia in order to contain the interests of Russia and China in the Asia-Pacific. Sergei Lavrov says that Western states are trying to master the Southeast Asia region. According to the Russian minister, Washington's Indo-Pacific strategy is meant to bypass the structures for regional cooperation. Lavrov was speaking after attending the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. He will also head to the Russian delegation on the upcoming summit of the G20 countries in Bali, Indonesia. U.S. President Joe Biden had told ASEAN leaders that Washington is committed to building an Indo-Pacific that's free and open. Moscow and Beijing, however, view the U.S. presence in the region as a threat. The head of the International Monetary Fund warning of risks to the global economy from rivalry between China and the United States. Kristalina Georgieva has warned of, in her words, sleepwalking into a poorer and less secure world. She raised the possibility of a second Cold War, stressing that the way Washington and Beijing are acting is pretty irresponsible. The IMF chief criticized tariffs imposed on Chinese imports under former U.S. President Trump. Georgieva said that duties are counterproductive and weren't carefully thought through. The issue of tariffs is just one of the sticking points that have soured the U.S.-China relations in recent years. Other bowls of contention include the South China Sea sovereignty, Taiwan, technology, cybersecurity, Hong Kong's autonomy, and the origins of the COVID pandemic. Dozens of Americans have gathered outside an election office in the U.S. city of Phoenix to protest midterm election results. The rally was organized by supporters of former President Donald Trump. Protesters accused state officials of fraud, demanding a recount. Many in the group echo the former president's claim that he lost the 2020 election due to voter fraud. They called on the military to intervene in the Arizona election.
This is a call out to the U.S. military. We, the people, can no longer combat these tyrants anymore by ourselves. We need military intervention. We, the people, are requesting military step in and redo our election. It was fake and false. Our government is full of corrupt people.
The Democratic Senator Mark Kelly is projected to hold on to his seat in Arizona, defeating Republican Blake Masters. The U.S. midterm elections were held on the 8th of November. Republicans have made modest gains, but the Democrats retained majority control of the Senate after winning a pivotal race in the state of Nevada. They now have 50 Senate seats against 49 by Republicans. The seat in Georgia will be going to a runoff in December, and in case the Senate is divided equally between the two parties, then Vice President Kamala Harris will be casting the deciding vote. It's not yet final which party will control the House of Representatives, but Republicans are close to a win. Colin Campbell tells us what a Republican control of the House would mean for the future of political legislation.
Well, right now, Republicans, of course, are looking like they'll still hold on to the lead, even though numbers are still coming in from states like California. We did get a late win in the state of Colorado with with one of the senators winning over there. And so right now it was tied. So what the current president was looking at was a majority in both houses. But what happened was, just this afternoon, we had the announcement that there would be a lead coming from Democrats in the Senate. So now we're looking at the House. Right now, Republicans hold the lead, but we're still getting numbers coming in that could indicate that the Republicans may hold on to the House. And if they did, it would mean that they would set the agenda largely for any type of political legislation that would be coming along throughout Congress. They would kind of set the pace. They would be the one kind of dictate what the topics were that would be discussed and to be voted on. However, if the Republicans do lose the House, if the Democrats manage to hold on to it, that would give Biden a very clear mandate almost to really continue with his agenda. Usually the party that is in power loses many seats in the midterm election, which could may not happen with the current president if Democrats hold on to the House.
The Ukrainian president says that Russian forces destroyed critical infrastructure in the southern city of Kherson before pulling out of that area.
As of this evening, the defense forces have established control in more than 60 settlements of Kherson region. The police have also started the stabilization measures. Stabilization measures are also ongoing in Kherson. Our explosive experts have a lot of work everywhere in the free territory. Almost 2,000 explosive items have already been removed. Mines, tripwires, unexploded ammunition. Before fleeing from Kherson, the occupiers destroyed all critical infrastructure, communications, supply, water, heat, and electricity.
Zelensky says extremely fierce fighting is going on in Donetsk region east, and Russia's military order to pull out of Kherson on Thursday. Russian commander in Ukraine said it was no longer possible to keep supplying the city. Kherson was one of four regions Ukraine did Moscow annexed in September. And that brings to the end of this news broadcast from Tehran.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Faith through action. Sunday, the 5th of Ramadan, 1394, the 22nd of September, 1974. There are a handful of other verses at the end of Surah Anfal which restate the duties associated with faith mentioned here, such as prayer, zakat, holding fast to Allah. It also mentions some duties associated with faith from another perspective. Let us turn to these now. Indeed, those who have believed and migrated and struggled with their possessions and their persons, and against their possessions and their persons, and those who gave them shelter when they were refugees without a home, and helped, they are guardians of one another. They are bound together and on the same side. They are of a single substance. They are the bricks and mortar of a single structure.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The likeness of the faithful is like an edifice. They support one another. Have you seen how these bricks go together in these ornate ceilings? Each brick is a single believer. Each believer is a single brick. They fit together and support one another. Together they form a structure that takes great effort to demolish. Tens of bricks side by side. This one brick helps to protect the whole, and the whole all help to protect this one brick. They are guardians of one another. Held together by strong bonds, united. And those who have believed. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 72. Pay attention here. What about those who have believed, who have faith in their hearts, but did not migrate? They believed, but they didn't act on the moral duties that arise from their faith. What about them? You have no guardianship, wilayah, in relation to them until they migrate. These are not bound to you. They are not a part of you. There is no relationship or guardianship between the two of you. Until when? Until they migrate. Until they follow through on the moral duties to which faith is attached. Hollowed out faith is no use in this world, dear brother. It does not produce any effects on the Islamic society. As for the hereafter, this is a separate discussion. You have no guardianship in relation to them until they migrate. There is another verse which is very relevant to what we are discussing here, and it comes just a few verses after those we have been discussing. Allah says, those who have believed, migrated, and struggled in the way of Allah, and those who gave them shelter and helped, it is they who are the truly faithful. The Quran, Surah 8, verse 74. So, if those who emigrate, struggle, give shelter, and help are the truly faithful, what are everyone else? They are false believers.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thank you. As the war drags on in Ukraine, the gloomy economic outlook continues to trigger protests across Europe. Demonstrators in several European countries have hit the streets for pay rises and better working conditions. In the UK, tens of thousands of nurses will go on a strike for the first time, demanding better pay as the cost of living soars. The industrial action would begin before the end of the year, after the first vote on strike action in its 106-year-old history. Unions say that the salaries of nurses have dropped by up to 20% in real terms over the last 10 years. That has left members struggling to feed their families and to pay their bills. Hundreds of workers at London's Heathrow Airport will walk out in the run-up to the Soccer World Cup this month over demands for better pay. The 700 workers will strike for 3 days starting from November 18th. In Greece, workers have held a 24-hour general strike, which has seen thousands of protesters march to the streets of Athens and the northern city of Thessaloniki. Clashes also erupted between protesters and police forces. And the French capital, Paris, commuters have faced transport delays. As metro workers called a major one-day pay strike, unions have staged strikes across several sectors in recent weeks, seeking pay hikes or increased hiring, as spiraling energy costs feed into widespread inflation. The protests come amid a gloomy outlook in Europe as Russia's war in Ukraine takes a rising toll on Europe's economies. The International Monetary Fund has predicted that Europe's advanced economies will grow by just 0.6% next year. It also says that this winter, more than half of the countries in the euro area will experience technical recessions. Germany, which is considered EU's biggest economy, is also expected to go into a recession in the next year.
The German economy has been built on cheap energy, cheap gas from Russia, and this business model is over. So Germany has to fasten to produce renewable energy and then go back on track with its business model. But this will take a couple of years.
Technically, a recession means that at least two consecutive quarters of shrinking output will occur. Next year, Europe's output and income will be nearly half a trillion euros lower as compared to the IMF's pre-war forecasts.
We have downgraded three times since October last year our growth projections. Last time we brought 22 to 3.2% growth, and for 23 projections was 2.9%. We will see, we always come around the annual meetings with our World Economic Outlook, that we are further downgrading our growth projections for next year.
The Eurozone has been battling against surging inflation for about a year. Inflation hit a historic high of 10.7% last month. Given the historic levels of inflation, the European Central Bank has announced three rate hikes this year, bringing the main rate from negative territory to 1.5% currently. Soaring costs with energy have been the main driver of higher inflation across the Eurozone.
From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28th attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home, these incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have spiked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence. as an answer to unwanted results. Nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States. And the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he's going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
The 2022 midterm elections are the first vote since the January 6th Capitol riot. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. Dozens of Republican candidates who could be elected as governors or elected administrators in key states have also echoed Trump's claims of fraud in his 2020 presidential election defeat. Election forecasters predicted that Republicans are likely to pick up roughly 25 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, more than enough to win a majority. From the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to block the certification of the presidential election results to the October 28th attack on U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home. These incidents are among the most high-profile instances of political violence in America in recent times. Now, many believe the problem has gone from bad to worse in recent weeks. Harassment of political candidates and voter intimidation have been reported in many parts of the country, prompting some local authorities to elevate vigilance on Election Day. Also, threats against members of Congress are up tenfold. According to Capitol Police, more than 9,600 threats against members of Congress were recorded last year. Threats against federal judges have sparked 400% in the past 6 years to more than 4,200 in 2021. Also, election poll workers have received hundreds of violent threats, leading many to resign from their positions and discouraging others from volunteering in first place. Analysts believe the current trend of increased threats to lawmakers and election officials, extremist candidates running for office, disinformation and heated rhetoric are raising the risk of domestic terrorism and other forms of extreme violence in the United States. That's why a new survey suggests that almost 1 in 5 Americans agree that violence is sometimes needed to protect democracy when elected leaders will not. Therefore, U.S. politics is now in danger of spilling over into street violence. As an answer to unwanted results, nearly 9 in 10 Americans are concerned that political divisions have intensified to the point that there is a risk of politically motivated violence in the United States. And the 2022 midterm elections could act as a catalyst for future domestic extremist violence in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has sounded the alarm over threats to democracy in his closing arguments ahead of the midterm elections.
Democracy is on the ballot. Political violence and intimidation are on the rise all across America. And you remember January 6th, the angry mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol, attacked law enforcement, hunted down elected officials, erected gallows to hang Vice President Pence. Well, West's opponent supported that mob. Who the hell do they think they are?
Biden has called on Americans to accept the election results and avoid resorting to violence. Also, former U.S. President Donald Trump said he's expecting a Republican victory in the elections. Trump has also vowed to make a big announcement next week, hinting that he is going to run for the 2024 presidential election.
This is the year we're going to take back the House, we're going to take back the Senate, and we're going to take back America. And in 2024, most importantly, we are going to take back our magnificent White House. I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
The 2022 midterm elections are the first vote since the January 6 Capitol riot. Democrats have been campaigning around what they call the threat a Republican win would pose to U.S. democracy. Republicans, however, have focused their campaign on such issues as soaring inflation and the scale of violent crimes. Dozens of Republican candidates who could be elected as governors or elected administrators in key states have also echoed Trump's claims of fraud in his 2020 presidential election defeat. Election forecasters predicted that Republicans are likely to pick up roughly 25 seats in the 435-seat House of Representatives, more than enough to win a majority.
UN's Climate Change Summit, Secretary General Antonio Guterres responded to a UN report released on Sunday by saying that the planet is sending a distress signal.
Greenhouse gas emissions are now on course to rise by 10%. And meanwhile, temperatures are on course to rise by as much as 2.8 degrees with the present policies in place by the end of the century. And that means our planet is on course for reaching tipping points and that will make climate chaos irreversible and forever bake in catastrophic temperature rise. We need to move from tipping points to turning points for hope.
The report had indicated that the past 8 years are said to have had the warmest climates to ever be recorded. The report had also indicated that global temperatures have risen by 1.15 degrees Celsius since the pre-industrial era, catastrophically accelerating rise in sea levels, glacier mass loss, and unprecedented heat waves. World leaders are discussing solutions in Sharm el-Sheikh's Red Sea Resort in Egypt, while the event is hosted by the Egyptian foreign minister, who emphasized on the magnitude of the challenge that now faces the world. The outgoing chair of the talks and British official Alok Sharma mentioned some political reasons as one of the major causes for the impediment of global efforts concerning the environment, specifically the Ukraine war.
War in Ukraine has precipitated multiple global crises: energy and food insecurity, inflationary pressures, and spiraling debt. And these crises have compounded existing climate vulnerabilities and the scarring effects of the pandemic.
But then he went back on the topic of actual climate catastrophes and pointed out the devastating Pakistan and Nigeria floods, as well as unprecedented droughts in Europe, China, and the US. Speaking of, US President Joe Biden is expected to attend the event later in the week. He's usually enthusiastic about climate events. After all, it was Biden who got the U.S. back into the Paris Climate Accord after Trump pulled out of it. But apparently, neither his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping nor Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi are expected to attend, with China and India being among the biggest polluters of the world. Their absence has cast much doubt over the effectiveness of any potential deal planned to cut emissions during the summit. The treaty was adopted in 2015 between 196 parties, including the EU, at the UN Climate Change Conference near Paris. It demands a 50% cut in global emissions until the year of 2030 to keep the temperature rises to well below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably below 1.5. The eventual goal is to reach net zero emissions by the middle of the 21st century. The treaty has determined an aggregate contribution for each country in terms of how much they need to cut down on their emissions. The UK is one of the signatories to the accord, and their share of emissions reductions by 2030 is said to be on the higher end of the spectrum. They are expected to cut down on their emissions by 68% by 2030 compared to UK's emissions in 1990. There have been plans set in motion, but in a document presented by the Secretary of State for Business, Energy and Industrial Energy to the Parliament, the war in Ukraine is mentioned as the reason that prompted the UK Prime Minister to do a, quote, independent review of the government's approach to meeting its net zero 2050 target. That independent review turned into a rather counterproductive decision. The UK has reversed its fracking ban as a result of the energy crisis it is currently going through. Fracking, short for hydraulic fracturing, is a process that involves injecting water, chemicals, and sand into the cracks of the earth at high pressure to widen the cracks and allow for extraction of oil and gas, in the case of the UK, only gas, from shale formations. The ban was introduced in 2019 when an earthquake occurred near Britain's only remaining fracking site. Fracking sites are known to release various forms of toxins and pollutants into the air, including chemicals that can cause severe headaches, asthma symptoms, childhood leukemia, cardiac problems, and even birth defects. Among the 1,000-plus chemicals used in fracking, some are even known to cause cancer. But those were only the negative effects of fracking on humans. For the environment, the vast amount of wastewater and greenhouse gases released, such as methane, will cause irreversible harm. The US isn't hit as hard as the EU as a result of the war in Ukraine, so their arms sales that will in effect prolong the war might even have a net positive effect for the country. But the EU that is hurting the most from the war is getting the short end of the stick. They are scrambling for other means of energy procurement, and the US might just be their last resort. A US that has increased its price of gas for an increasingly desperate Europe, in dire need of energy, waiting for a difficult winter.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Karimi. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
That's right. Sheikh Karimi, thank you very much again for accepting my invitation to the program. For today's discussion, we want to talk about why Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi wa salam are called Sayyid and the sons of Prophet Muhammad. First of all, let's refer to these, why they are called the children and the sons of Prophet Muhammad, and whether they are considered as Sayyid or not, because they were the sons of the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So there are two questions here. First of all, why Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi as-salam, and by the same token, the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, we call them Yabna Rasulullah, the sons of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. And second of all, are they Sayyid? Because the question is that according to Islamic laws, if your mother is Sayyid, you're not considered a Sayyid. It's only through father that you can be a Sayyid. So they were the children of the Prophet through Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha, so they cannot be Sayyid. Mm-hmm. So the point is that, first of all, the Sayyid is a concept in jurisprudence, a technical term mainly in jurisprudence.
Yes.
And we have some special Islamic laws for Sadat, the plural for Sayyid. And for that, we have a definition. And the definition is that all the children of Hashim, one of the ancestors of the Prophet, all of them are Sayyid. And of course, it is only through sons and fathers. So for that, Imam Ali alayhi salam is also a Sayyid.
That's right.
So we shouldn't think that only the children of the Prophet are Sayyid. No, all the children of Hashim are Sayyid, meaning one of the forefathers of the Prophet. And Imam Ali alayhi salam himself is one of the children of Hashim.
Yes.
So he's Sayyid. And that is why Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are also Sayyid.
That's right.
So this is one point. And the second point is that, as I mentioned, this is only a concept. I mean, the fact that it is true that siyada is transmitted, if we put it this way, only through fathers. I
yes.
mean, if your mother is Sayyid, you cannot be, you are not considered as her son.
You mean by blood chain, it's not considered as a Sayyid?
As a Sayyid.
Okay.
But this is only a term within Islamic jurisprudence. There are some Islamic laws for being a Sayyid. But doesn't mean that you are not considered as an as a family member of the Prophet, as an offspring of the Prophet. No, of course you are from what we call it dhurriya, from the descendants of the Prophet. Only there are some Islamic laws for sadat, for that definition, through fathers. And the people who are called nowadays mirza, meaning that their mother is Sayyid, they do not share the same Islamic laws.
Yes.
But for sure they are also, they belong to the same family members, to the same descendants and dhurriya.
And you mean by lies, for example, dedication of khums or something
exactly.
like that?
They are deprived of zakat and they are given khums.
Yes.
And it doesn't make much difference,
yes,
of course.
Okay.
But when it comes to respecting the people, respecting if you want to, I mean, respect the family members of the Prophet, the same people who are called mirza, they are also belonging to the same family.
Yes.
And the next point is that, I mean, it's not a kind of discrimination against women, because if we have a man, a father, and he is Sayyid, his children are Sayyid, whether they are girls or boys. It doesn't make any difference.
Okay.
Now, having said that, there are a couple of narrations which I mean clarify some other aspects of this question. There is an interesting I'm just telling you these stories to prove that Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi as-salam are the sons of the Prophet.
Okay.
Because this is another part of the question, and also about the concept of siyada.
And we mean by son is that, for sure, they are the grandsons of Prophet Muhammad. But why they are directly referred to, as you said in narrations, as the son?
They are referred to as the sons of the Prophet.
Abna.
In a debate between Ma'mun, the Abbasid Caliph, and Imam Rida alayhi salam, we know that Ma'mun was interested in holding debates, and Imam Rida alayhi salam was invited. And Ma'mun is one of the Abbasid Caliphs, and we know that Abbas is also one of the Sadat, one of the offspring of Hashim. So Ma'mun thought that I'm a Sayyid, you, Imam Rida alayhi salam, are also a Sayyid, so we are the same when it comes to virtue. We belong to the same family. Both of us are Sayyid. And Imam Rida alayhi salam said that, imagine now that the Holy Prophet is coming to our session and he asks for your daughter's hand for marriage.
Yes.
What will you do? Mahmoud said that, of course, I will be happy for that. I will give my daughter to the Holy Prophet to get married with her. Then Imam Rida alayhi salam said that, can I be happy with the same marriage? I mean, is it possible for the Prophet to come to me and ask for my daughter's hand for marriage? Mahmoud said that, of course not. Then he himself said that, yes, I cannot compare myself to you. I mean, the way you are connected to the Prophet is, of course, different.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Imam al-Kadim alayhi salam says that once I went to the court of Harun al-Rashid, another Abbasid caliph, and he asked me some questions. One of them was that, how do you consider yourself as a son of the Prophet and as a generation, offspring from the Prophet? And the Prophet did not have any son, and he had only Fatima Zahra salamun alayha, and you are the grandchildren of the Prophet through a daughter, through a girl. That is Fatima Zahra salamullahi alayha. And Imam al-Kadim alayhi salam said the following, which also proves the fact that Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, they are the reason they are called the sons of the Prophet.
Yes.
In chapter An'am, verse 84, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ وَوَهَبْنَا لَهُ إِسْحَاقَ وَيَعْقُوبَ كُلًّا هَدَيْنَا. And we gave him that is Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam, we gave him Isaac, Ishaq, and Jacob, Ya'qub alayhi salam. Kullan hadayna, we guided each of them. Wa Nuhan hadayna min qabl, and Nuh we had guided before. Wa min dhurriyatihi Dawuda wa Sulaymana wa Ayyuba wa Yusufa wa Musa wa Harun. And from his offspring, David, Solomon, Job, Joseph, Moses, and Harun. وَكَذَلِكَ نَجْزِ الْمُحْسَنِينَ. And thus we do reward the virtuous. And the next verse, 85, reads, وَذَكَرِيَّا وَيَحْيَا وَعِيسَى وَإِلْيَاسَ. And Zakaria, John, Jesus, and Ilyas. So the point is that in this verse, all these prophets are considered as the children and offspring of Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam.
Yes.
Now, Imam al-Kadim alayhi salam says that, I asked Harun that, O Harun, who is the father of Jesus? He says that Jesus did not have any father. It was only Mary as his mother. Then Imam al-Kadim alayhi salam tells him that, so why in this verse, Jesus alayhi salam is considered as one of the children of Ibrahim? Isa doesn't have any father. So his relation to Ibrahim alayhi salam is only through his mother, Lady Maryam salamullahi alayha. So this verse is confirming the fact that people can be considered as a descendant of another person through mother too.
Okay.
Isa alayhi salam is considered as one of the children, wa min dhurriyatihi, of Ibrahim alayhi salam, while he didn't have any father.
Mm-hmm.
It was only through mother.
That's right. So, in the Arab Peninsula, the father had, I think the blood of the father was really important, isn't it?
I think
so many ambiguities now are considered this, that why, for example, the line of your imams are not related to the Prophet of Islam. Is it so? Because it's coming from the mother side, Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra.
Yeah, we are referring to some verses of the Quran, mm-hmm. which prove that this is confirmed by the Noble Book of Quran too. This was one verse. In another verse, in Tafsir al-Ayyashi, it's been mentioned that once Hajjaj asked for a person called Yahya ibn Mu'ammar. And Hajjaj told him that, I've heard that you call Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhim as-salam as the sons of the Prophet. I have read the Quran fully. I didn't find any verse referring to this point. Yahya says that, have you recited chapter Al-An'am? In chapter Al-An'am, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says the same verse, the verse that I recited, that Isa is one of the offspring of Ibrahim alayhi salam. Was Isa one of the offspring of Ibrahim? Hajjaj said that yes. And then he said, that, did he have any father? He said no. So the relation between Isa and Ibrahim alayhi salam was through his mother. Mm-hmm. And then Hajjaj said that you're right. This is in Tafsir al-Mizan, volume 7, page 261. There is another very interesting narration which refers to different aspects of this question. Abu al-Jarud, one of the companions of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, says that the Imam told me that why do people say about Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi salam, meaning that non-Shi'as. Abu Jarud says that I told the Imam that they claim that Hassan and Hussein alayhi salam are not the sons of the Prophet. Imam asks, so how do you argue against them? He says that we refer to the verse of Min Dhurriyatihi Dawood wa Suleiman, the verse that I recited.
Yes.
Then the Imam says that, so what is their answer? So we are going to the next stage. Mm-hmm. Abu Jarud says that they say that they claim that this is not, although they might be called sons, but this is not a son through blood. Then the Imam says that, so what is your answer? Here we have another verse referring to the fact that no, explicitly Imam al-Hasan and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam are called Ibn in the Noble Book of Quran, which referring to the fact that they are, sons of the Prophet through blood too. And that is the famous verse of Mubahala, chapter Ali Imran, verse 61. The famous story of Mubahala.
Yes.
When the Christians of Najran came to the Prophet and they wanted to have a kind of mutual cursing with the Prophet. And based on that story, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says the Prophet that قُلْ تَعَالَوْ نَدْعَ أَبْنَاءَنَا وَأَبْنَاءَكُمْ وَنِسَاءَنَا وَنِسَاءَكُمْ وَأَنفُسَنَا وَأَنفُسَكُمْ.
Yes.
Tell them that let us call our sons and your sons, our women, your women, ourselves and yourselves, our souls and
Your souls.
Your souls. Yes. And for sure, all the narrations, unanimously in Shia and Sunni collections of hadith refer to the fact that Abna'ana in this verse is referring to no one but Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi
as-salam. That's all right.
So this verse is very explicit in that Imam al-Hassan and Imam al-Hussein alayhi as-salam can be called as the sons of the Prophet.
That's all right.
And then we have another stage. Imam says that, okay, what is their answer? They say that some of them, they say that in Arabic language, sometimes you call the sons of other people as your son. I mean, you call a boy, oh, my son, come to me.
Yes,
and
yes.
He's not your son. It has a figurative meaning.
Yes.
Then Imam says that, okay, what is your answer? He says that I recite the verse 23 of chapter An-Nisa. حُرَّمَتْ عَلَيْكُمْ أُمَّهَاتُكُمْ وَبَنَاتُكُمْ And then next part of the verse, which says that you are not allowed to get married with those who are, your close relatives, the mahram. So Imam says that, ask them, is the Prophet able to, na'udhu billah, marry the daughters of Hassan and Hussein, alayhi as-salam? Of course not. So if this is the case, then it's not the case that this is in a figurative meaning. They are really the sons of the Prophet, and that is why we have the fact that the Holy Prophet cannot marry their daughters.
That's right.
So these are some of the explicit verses of the Quran referring to the fact that Imam al-Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam, and by the same token the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, can be called as the son of the Prophet. And when it comes to the narration, there are many narrations again in Shia and Sunni sources according to which the Holy Prophet has called them as Ibnai. Hadan Ibnai, man ahabbahuma faqad ahabbani. These two, Hassan and Hussein, are my sons.
That's right.
And those who love them, they have loved me, or Ibna ibnayya hadain rayhanatayya min ad-dunya. These two sons of me are two good smelling flowers for me. So, according to these narrations, the Holy Prophet has called them his sons too. But why they are Sayyid, as I mentioned, because of the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam is also a Sayyid. Because of that definition in Islamic jurisprudence that all the descendants of Hashim are called Sayyid.
And we know that Prophet Muhammad, he did not have any son. So we can say his grandson somehow, emotionally speaking, replaced the status of a son for him. referring, we can say, to Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein as the son, the beloved, we can say, and the masters of the use of paradise. Thank you much, Sheikh Karimi, for a nice elaboration. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and